Well, greetings to all of you out there, many of whom I hope are going to become constant listeners or constant readers. My name's Nick DeOlias, and I am certainly happy you're giving this podcast, one that I'm calling The Far Middle, a listen, and I hope you're going to give my upcoming book, The Leech, a read. Now, I just referenced three things at the start that I probably need to explain. First was this constant reader, constant listener that I mentioned. Second thing was the podcast, The Far Middle. And the third thing was my upcoming book, The Leech. So let's start with the constant listener. That's a nod to one of my favorite literary writers out there, Stephen King. He references his regulars as constant readers. And in that vein, I hope you become a constant listener of this podcast and a constant reader of my website, nickdeolias.com, along with the new book that I just mentioned, The Leech, that this podcast is going to accompany. I love books. I'm going to make consistent references to great authors and works when I'm writing and when I'm speaking. This podcast, I'm sure, will not be an exception. And I know that Stephen King is looked down on by some of the elite when it comes to literary genius. But that guy, he got a hold of me in my mid-teens with some of his epic works like Salem's Lot, Pet Sematary, and what I think his best novel ever was, which was The Stand. And then you start to think about the movies that this guy has created through the years. Stand By Me, Shawshank Redemption, there's The Green Mile, Carrie, and on it goes. So even though his recent works might not carry the same oomph his earlier masterpieces carry, and even though I don't agree with his brand of politics, to say the least, the guy is a genius, or at a minimum, he was a genius earlier in his career. I also mentioned this podcast at the beginning, The Far Middle. And initially, this podcast is going to post once a week. Each installment is going to cover the next chapter of the upcoming book, The Leech. Once the book is posted online in its entirety, the podcast will continue on covering various topics of interest, and it'll be very broad-ranging. We'll cover public policy, we'll talk about energy, we'll talk about business, culture, and so on. It'll be very wide-ranging. Now, why the name for the podcast of The Far Middle? Well, if you peruse my website, nickdeolias.com, and you spend a few minutes on it, you'll quickly come away, I hope, with the impression that what I advocate for is not far right, it's not far left, but instead it's middle, as in middle of the road, as in middle class, as in moderate. And these days, such things and such lanes, they're the outliers. Thus, the idea of naming my philosophy in the podcast, The Far Middle. Okay, the last thing that I made reference to at the open was my new book, The Leech. If you go to nickdeolias.com, you can read a summary about what The Leech is and what the book is about. And the original plan was to publish the book in the traditional rollout. But as publication date moved closer, more and more people, a lot of them young people, a lot of them small business owners, people in the industry that I work in, energy, and so on, they were really interested in the book. But they wanted a copy sent to them, as in they wanted a copy for free. So I got to thinking, why not do what I think Charles Dickens did back in his day, and I know Stephen King did with The Green Mile, why not serialize publication on the website in chapter installments, and have each chapter that posts be accompanied by a podcast? It'll dive deeper into the subject of the chapter at hand. So the idea was to disseminate the book and the concepts therein by democratizing the book for all to access for free. My publisher, Republic Books, they were very supportive of the idea, and before you knew it, we set up an arrangement where we release the book on the website, and the publisher, which is a nonprofit enterprise, will receive a portion of the royalties upon sale back to them. By the way, if you get a chance, check out Republic Books on the web and when you've got a few minutes. The founders of Republic, Eric Campman and Al Regnery, they are epic figures in the publishing world and really took it upon themselves to start up Republic, much to the benefit of many of us. So that covers how we got here, soon to be constant listener, constant website browser, and constant reader. Maybe spending just a minute about myself and my backstory, so to speak, to help put things in context about some of the things and issues that we hope to discuss and cover in the podcast and with the website. I think if you look at sort of my background and experience, I could rattle off maybe a typical resume that you hear from most or that you traditionally see out there, but maybe a better way of approaching this is just to think about some of the core items or issues that drive the essence of who I am And there's two that really come to mind that I think would be helpful or insightful. One is my Italian-American heritage. I think one of the most special, unique, important things, whatever you want to ascribe to it along those terms, about the United States and about America is how it's a meshing of people from many different cultures, many different ethnicities through history that have basically preserved a component of that heritage. So for Italian Americans, of course, there's a lot of that heritage to look at culturally in terms of what we contributed, what we've preserved today as part of that experience and culture. And then also meshing into what it means to be an American or what it means to be the United States and evolving and integrating into that. And that's sort of that binary dynamic that does, I think, make us special and unique. And being Italian American, that's a great example of that type of a dynamic at work. So I love any of these organizations, individuals, institutions that basically celebrate, preserve, remember, evolve just the ethnic history and the ethnic legacy that our current generation, we here today, have inherited and now have a duty to carry on and take to the next level in the context of being a quote unquote American. I think that's a really important aspect of who we are as a nation. The second thing that really sort of stands out in my mind about what has formed me or what has driven me through the years and through life is the city that I'm from and the region that I'm from, Pittsburgh in Western Pennsylvania. And the experience of Pittsburgh and what it stands for is so much. I mean, when you think about our history in this city and the region of Western Pennsylvania, it is the ideal, the American ideal of a city that you built upon true industry. And it was originally populated by an immigrant class. The most, I think, impressive thing about it that resonates with me, it's a place where you arrive with nothing but your name, nothing but your work ethic, and you made a life and you were able to make a good life. And before you knew it, your kids were able to make an even better life and your grandkids were making lives that you couldn't even contemplate when you first arrived and couldn't contemplate in a good way. It turned out in way beyond your wildest positive dreams. So it's not a good place to call home. It's a great place to call home. It stays with you. I've lived here my entire life. Interestingly, and maybe somewhat by chance, but somewhat by choice, I've lived my entire life outside of college. I've lived my entire life within a 5-mile radius of where I was born. So I've lived in a very tight circle, so to speak, by choice. I think that I couldn't even fathom living anywhere else, although I love to travel. And I think other places within this country and other places across the globe are frankly awesome, but they're not Pittsburgh. They're not Western Pennsylvania. And for me, that's where I want to stay and where I want to continue on. The other thing that's really interesting about Pittsburgh, and you're going to hear this theme pop up different ways, different chapters, different podcasts over time, is that when you think about Western Pennsylvania and you think of Pittsburgh, we tend to associate it logically with Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, Pittsburgh being the largest cities and Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is a discrete state. But when you think about us culturally and you think about our historical legacy, how we got to where we are, where we're going into the future, Western Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh in many ways is not so much a part of Pennsylvania proper or Eastern Pennsylvania as it is what I'll call the capital, socially, culturally, historically, industrially, the capital of Appalachia. So Western Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh, we probably, in fact, I think we absolutely have much more in common with regions like upstate New York, Eastern Ohio, West Virginia, probably all the way down into Southern Appalachia, more in common with those regions and those people that populate and drive and lead those regions than we do with, say, Philadelphia, even though Philadelphia is in the same state as Pittsburgh is. So why is that? Well, that's because it's a bit of a different history when you get to Western Pennsylvania, a bit of a different outlook, and a bit of a different view on the world and values and everything that goes with it. And I think those are good things. So you always have this battle, this debate that's ensuing in Pittsburgh, and I'm sure it occurs in other sort of Midwestern or Appalachian regions and cities about what we need to do moving forward. So you have what I reference and I will typically reference as elites that are constantly looking to drive this region or this city more toward trying to become a Boston, a New York, a Philadelphia, a coastal California, basically a coastal view and more of an urban view of the United States as being the model that we want to strive toward. And in many ways, you know, you're sort of chasing, I guess, the shiny ideal of what those places are versus maybe what they actually are. And you hear that quite a bit as you get closer to sort of the elite circles within this region. But when you look at what makes us special and where the values of this great region reside, that they're very much not in line, not in tune with Boston, Washington, New York, sort of the East Coast corridor, or Los Angeles, San Francisco, et cetera, out on the West Coast. There's something different here. It's unique in its own special way. And I feel, and I've always been in the camp, that that's something about Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania that we should embrace, not try to change, not try to run away from, but to embrace it as part of the secret sauce, so to speak, that makes this place so exemplary and such a great place to live and to grow up. Now, I love history, and I'm a bit of a student or a novice, depending on the subject and the time of day or year, on history. And one of the really, I think, intriguing things about Western Pennsylvania is the history that we have when you've got this ongoing debate of the elite saying we should be running more toward sort of the coastal model of things and the coastal urban model of things versus embracing what we are and taking it to the next level. If you go back to the time of our founding fathers, many of you may not know this, but industrious Appalachia was someone and something as a region that that was always trying to remain independent relative to what I would call the arrogance of the elites. You go back to the Whiskey Rebellion, back at the time when Washington was president in the 1790s, you basically had a new federal government that was looking to raise revenue and wanted to tax a core industry of Appalachia and Western Pennsylvania at the time, which was whiskey production. So when that occurred, that was not well received by Western Pennsylvanians, and the farmers that were basically the industry in this region at the time, they stood up and they pushed back, and frankly, they revolted. And the federal government ended up raising a militia to put down what at the time was basically an insurrection. So that's back in, like I said, the 1790s when this country was first forming. But what was that dynamic? The dynamic was needed to raise revenue, basically needed to procure value from one demographic or one region of this country, which at the time was Appalachia, Western Pennsylvania, and then redistribute it to another. At the time, it was, again, sort of government debt, paying for the war and getting the new nation started, and a lot of that money or proceeds being redistributed to areas like Philadelphia, New York, and ultimately Washington, D.C., then when it would become our capital. Now, you fast forward from the 1790s to today, boy, the more times change, the more things stay the same. So today, what do you have? Well, today you've got those coastal elites in those sort of same areas. And now you can put on top of it coastal California with Los Angeles and San Francisco. And you've got a massive and very powerful federal government, much different than federal government back in the 1790s. But what's in common? Well, they still continue to look down upon regions like Western Pennsylvania. And they're working to tax and basically squeeze the lifeblood out of this region. So back then it was a tax on whiskey, which was the primary product, right? Or value creation product that was made here. And today it might be something like a carbon tax or energy policy where it's looking to redistribute value, redistribute wealth from things like the natural gas industry or from manufacturing industries that are established in this region, and then reallocating that value to something else that's a more favored or better viewed endeavor. So that dynamic really does tend to create an attribute of this region that you'll quickly find if you spend any time here, and I think it's a good one, which is a little bit of a chip on the shoulder mentality. You've got that in Western Pennsylvania. You've got that in the city of Pittsburgh. You've basically got that in Northern Appalachia. And I think that I'm no exception to that. I think I carry that chip on my shoulder as well. So forgive us and forgive me if that mentality or that attitude sometimes comes out in these podcasts when we're talking about issues that we feel quite passionate about. The other thing about Western Pennsylvania that I think is really important to understand that informs you a little more about myself or about this region and why some of these issues are going to play so prominent to us and why we're so passionate about it. One, Western Pennsylvania has a great spectrum of everything from urban, big city life in Pittsburgh to just what you think about when you think of rural and some great, beautiful rural communities, maybe a half hour drive from the urban center. And then you've got obviously suburbia in between. So there's that spectrum that you don't always experience in different parts of the country. You might have a completely rural area of the country with not much of an urban presence, or you might have a very built up urban area through an urban corridor, but not much when it comes to any sort of rural presence close by. This region has the entire spectrum in very close proximity to one another. And my experience has basically mirrored that type of a spectrum. When I was earlier in my life as a child, I grew up, was raised in the city itself, in the inner city, in the urban areas of Pittsburgh. And then when I became a teenager and through my high school years and to this day now, I live in sort of the suburbs, what would considered to be the suburbs of the Pittsburgh area. And in my career, as I've spent more time and years in the energy industry, a lot of my time day by day is spent in the rural communities where a lot of the activity occurs with respect to natural gas development. So I've been able to experience and see and live amongst that spectrum through the years, which definitely provides, I think, a special sort of view of things and perspective that maybe you don't get elsewhere throughout the country. The second thing that's really special about this region is that it's seen, it has experienced what happens when policy allows things to occur, like achievement, like industry, free enterprise, individual rights to flourish. And it's also experienced the flip side, what happens when those things are not able to flourish on their own or as they should, and the downside that occurs from it. So if you just take my life as an experience, when I grew up, when I was born in the late 60s and in the early 70s, industry was doing quite well in this region. And it was that exemplar that I spoke about earlier, where you could show up with a work ethic and a drive, and you could make something of yourself and make a family sustaining wage and live in a very nice home and be able to provide for your children and all the good things that come with it. And as long as you kept that drive and you kept that work ethic, you were able to retire on that job and do quite well when it came to fulfilling your life's mission. Then when I became a youngster evolving into a teenager, that's when the economic downturn occurred. And there's many different reasons for what drove that, and we'll get into some of those, I think, in subsequent podcasts. But we do know this. We do know that it was devastating to the soul of this region. You would see, and many of us experienced that went through it, classmates, friends, families down the street, family members within your family itself. They were basically dislocated. They had to move out of the region. They went to far-flung areas to try to pursue economic opportunity to provide for their families. We saw what happened when those things go awry. And when those things went awry, things became very tense. When I was growing up and there was this trepidation that was hanging in the air about what you were going to be able to do with a career and being able to provide for your family, you saw a couple of things that came into play. You saw the idea of work-life balance. That wasn't a concept that many, if anybody, embraced at the time. There was no such thing as work-life balance. You did what you needed to do when it came to work and career. And basically, your parents and your grandparents embraced it even to a more extreme extent than you viewed it at that time. There was work, and then there was everything else that came after that. That's how you provided for your family. And the other side of this was that you would see individuals, and typically they were men, but also women back in the day, that because of that drive and that trepidation and the urgency, you saw their bodies break down over time. These were jobs, many of them, of course, blue collar, that took a toll on the body, that took a toll on the mind and the body. And by the time you saw somebody getting to their early 50s, they oftentimes were broken individuals, broken men, or in some instances, broken women physically. So you had this view where work-life balance was an odd concept. You would get a lot of strange stares back in the day in this region when it came to that. And no one that was in the community, so to speak, was a four-year college graduate. That was certainly the exception. And every parent, despite that, they had dreams of their kids going on to college and basically finding ways. And typically college was viewed as that path. I don't know if that's the case today, is what we'll discuss down the road, but finding ways and finding paths to break into better or higher socioeconomic castes or classes. What about politics and political leanings? Well, if you look at the specifics, I'm a registered Republican. I'm a historical Democrat. There's a lot of people in this region that would mirror that same sort of evolution. I feel at times that I think it was Ronald Reagan that said this, that I didn't leave the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party left me. I'll also say that if you would take a third of the Democratic Party platform and two thirds of maybe the Republican Party platform, and you combine them, the right third and the right two thirds, there'd be no stopping the United States. And that there would be a lot of residual benefit with people in countries outside of the United States that would also benefit from that residually. So in a way, it's exciting, but in a way, it's a frustrating situation and a bit of a shame that we haven't been able, or either party hasn't been able, to figure out how to get that done. In terms of political philosophy, socially, I'm quite liberal. I think that people should be allowed and free to make their own personal decisions, and government does not have a role in dictating that one way or another. And fiscally, from a dollars and cents perspective, I'm conservative. I think that governments, much like households, should live within their means, shouldn't perpetually outspend, and shouldn't perpetually run up deficits without recognizing that there's going to be serious consequence from that. Now, when you look to the 2016 election and the 2020 election and President Trump and what happened in 2020 with President Biden, I think you saw that dynamic that I just summarized really at play. The middle class, and it was really interesting, there was a great summation of the middle class that Mario Cuomo, Governor Cuomo's father, really summed up, I think, almost perfectly. And in his quote, let me read it here so that I don't misquote. He said, quote, "The middle class, the people not rich enough to be worry-free, but not poor enough to be on welfare. The middle class, those people who work for a living because they have to, not because some psychiatrist told them it was a convenient way to fill the interval between birth and eternity," end quote. That is a perfect summation of the middle class. That's in many ways a perfect summation of the fabric of Western Pennsylvania and the Pittsburgh region. And those individuals, and those are people that I love, those are people that I've spent my entire life around that form me into who I am. They are smart. They can realize when people are playing them lip service or basically abandoning them after they've proved their usefulness with respect to a vote or an election. And in many ways, I think they sort of epitomize a term that I came across a while ago, the forgotten man. And the forgotten man was originally coined by William Graham Sumner of Yale, and it was over 100 years ago when he coined it. But what is the forgotten man? Well, think about these attributes. Basically, someone that's too poor to have political influence, too rich to receive a helping hand, someone that's taken for granted by the political elite, someone who works, who votes, who prays, but he always ends up paying. I think that was a quote that Sumner used. He said, quote, "He works, he votes, generally he prays, but he always pays," end quote. These are also the people that are going to pay the biggest price for failed government or failed social engineering when it doesn't turn out as planned or as advertised. This is what we call today, I think, flyover country. You know, Western Pennsylvania might be smack in the middle of flyover country. And this is typically the class of people who end up sending their kids to fight and unfortunately die in wars that others are starting. And maybe the type of people that are labeled as deplorables by certain individuals not long ago. They're also in Western Pennsylvania, was the epitome of this. They're the ones who end up losing their jobs when these great and overarching views and trends of things like globalization take effect. That's where the rubber meets the road. That's where the job and the family suffer the consequences as things are offshored or industries exit. And I think they were also recently and to today, unfortunately, they're the ones that bear the biggest brunt of things like draconian shutdowns to deal with a pandemic. So I think when you look at the forgotten man and the attributes of Western Pennsylvania and what Mario Cuomo had summarized as the middle class, you see those dynamics coming into play when it comes to political leanings and politics and elections. And it wasn't a surprise that 2016 played out the way that it did, with sort of the blue wall crumbling down and the election turning out the way it did. And it wasn't a surprise that 2020 was as close of a run thing as it was, despite the headwinds of pandemic and shutdowns, and despite, frankly, the headwinds of the candidate himself, President Trump, with his cringeworthy quotes and moments on social media and his lack of decorum at various points in time. Nevertheless, it was a very close election. And I think that dynamic of the forgotten man in the middle class in that Western Pennsylvanian type that you can sort of mirror across other regions of the country, I think they played an outsized role and will continue to play an outsized role in how these things play out into the future. And politically, when it comes to philosophy, you know, beyond party affiliations or how elections play out with demographics and socioeconomic classes, philosophically, when it comes to politics, I am very much a libertarian who really values personal freedoms, favored by what you would, I guess, call modern liberals, and economic freedoms that would be favored by modern conservatives. So to me, that's what a libertarian is. Again, socially liberal, but also fiscally conservative. And if you look at both parties today, I don't think either of our major political parties is favoring that combination. I think what they're favoring today is more government, just different ways that you have more government, perhaps, but more government intervention into people's lives, into their bedrooms, and into their wallets, in all kinds of different and fantastic ways that we never would have imagined a short time ago. It was Edmund Burke who really, I think, summed this up quite well. He said, quote, "The parties are the gamesters, but government keeps the table and is sure to be the winner in the end," end quote. That's a far cry from government existing to serve the people, isn't it? But I think that's what we've got today. And I think that's largely what we've got with both parties, unfortunately. And until there's someone or something that's willing to split from that, we're going to see dynamics similar to what we saw in 2016 and 2020. And you'll see outliers coming from nowhere, like a Donald Trump, that appear on the scene and do things that frankly were unimaginable when you look at the history of how these things are supposed to play out. So I guess I'm a libertarian with a small L and a Republican maybe with a capital R typically. But I will tell you, when I find someone running for office who's a Democrat, but is closer to the libertarian philosophy than the Republican candidate, I've got zero hesitation throwing my full support behind him or her. So political philosophy, that's going to rise, for me, it's going to rise above political party affiliation. And I'm ready to switch horses the moment I see someone that embodies that type of a philosophy. And really, I think, too, with Trump and with the middle class and with what you saw in 16 and in 20 and where we're at today, I think you really see another dynamic at hand here. And that is, if I'm pro-middle class, in some ways I feel increasingly that I am, that means by definition, I'm also anti-expert class. And what do I mean by expert class? It's things that you see today in very numerous types of occurrences. One example would be how progressives or leftists today, they will obviously decry those who question the legitimacy of the Biden victory, right? That's a sanctioned, established election result. How could you question that outcome? But they're the same people, ironically, who spent 4+ years delegitimizing or trying to delegitimize the Trump victory. So you see that inconsistent philosophy being applied by the expert class. And when you look at Trump's rise and how he won the 16 election and what happened in the 4 years subsequent to 2016, there's a belief out there by many, including myself, that it really highlighted the flaws and failures of the expert class. So once Trump won, and you saw the 4 years that transpired since 2016, where did you see the failings of the expert class? Well, you saw the failings with the pollsters, right? So the elite that project how elections go and how they're supposed to behave, that was proved to be completely wrong in 16. And it wasn't much better of a projection in the 2020 election either, I might add. Why we still listen to pollsters, I don't know. You saw a failure of the expert class with academics, who basically predicted that a Trump election, the moment an opportunity came for him or the people in power to basically implement fascism upon the United States, it would occur. That never occurred. You saw the expert class with respect to them calling an assault on democracy, wherever you would turn or read, which for them was really any opposition to opposing expanded government, whether it's entitlements or government regulation or everything in between. So if you were against that, that was deemed as an assault on democracy. Yet we saw that to a large extent when it came to regulation over those 4 years, and democracy is alive and well, as we saw in the 2020 election. You saw the expert class fail in federal law enforcement with the whole Russia intervention and the probe that came from it and how that ended up being a hoax. And you saw the expert class fail in media, right, where they would drop factual truth and the rigor that went along with it and replace it with just this obsession to promote or hype a discrediting of an administration. You saw it with the failure of our foreign policy elite in the expert class. So, right, when we wanted to rename, or the decision was named, was made to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and what that would lead to, and how relations between Israel and the Arab world could never be normalized without the Palestinian issue being resolved. All that became sort of old thinking quickly as Israel normalized relations with wide swaths of the Arab world. The health experts in the expert class failed. Lockdowns, right? Draconian lockdowns being much better and stopping the spread, they weren't effective, frankly, in hindsight. And those that had severe lockdowns versus those that had mild lockdowns, there really wasn't that much of a difference with respect to pandemic and spread and infection rate and whatnot. And, you know, there's also this dynamic of the expert class where they become proponents of there's your truth and my truth. We're all entitled to our own view of the truth. Until you ask that individual or that expert, well, then what about, you know, someone like Trump's truth? Does that apply? They'll quickly say, no, that does not apply. So you saw a lot of inconsistencies, whether you're pro-Trump or anti-Trump. The one thing that you saw through these inconsistencies was really highlighting the failure of the expert class, which again, I feel many instances is an entity or a group that is opposed to the middle class, and thus opposed to areas like Western Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh and wider areas of the country. So to this day, I think the expert class or the elites, they're not going to accept any sort of blame for being wrong, despite the facts. So the question then arises, well, then why should we continue to rely on them with respect to their views and their predictions about what we should be doing in the future? And I think the reality is going to be for some time, unfortunately, that the expert class is in a bit of a revolt against the middle class, whether it's an official one or an unofficial one. I sometimes wonder if the expert class and the elite class actually despise the middle class, and if so, what we can do about that, because that would be an issue that would cause serious concern and should worry all of us. I'm hoping now that you're getting a feel for what's motivating me to speak up and deliver these podcasts or write the book, The Leech, or post the content on my website, nickdeolias.com. And part of that, of course, is just the general interest and drive to create. We've seen that in various walks and performing arts and literary areas and whatnot. And that's certainly a motivator. But the bigger issue is to speak up on behalf of very noble professions, great people, just vital regions of our country, the middle class, for lack of a better term, and stand up for them in a way where we're trying to speak some truth, whether it's to power or whether it's just to people in general. You saw, I think, these types of developments elsewhere throughout history. I mean, you go back to our founding fathers with Thomas Jefferson and his views on not being afraid to follow truth, no matter where it might lead you, and not to tolerate errors if your reason is there and you're able to combat it with reason. You saw it more recently, a number of decades ago, with celebrities like Jim Brown and Sam Cooke. You know, Sam Cooke could go on continuing to write hit records, and Jim Brown could have continued going on scoring touchdowns as one of the greatest. In fact, I think Jim Brown is the greatest football player ever when you look at it objectively. But they wanted something more. They felt a duty to do something beyond scoring the next touchdown and writing the next hit record. And for them, of course, that was civil rights and social change on that front, which led to some really great things. But you've seen that time and time again. And I feel that business people in today's world have a similar duty if they choose to pursue it and if they choose to go after that. And that was a huge motivator for me, considering what's at stake here with respect to people and regions of this country that I love. And what we're going to do through the course of these podcasts and in the book is really look at certain institutions and professions and things that are out there and really question what is the objective and what are they working toward optimizing versus what should be the objective and what they should be working to optimize. Those are two very different things, or perhaps what they're saying they're working toward when in reality they're working towards something very different. So that can involve politicians and bureaucrats that run the government. When you look at those individuals, how many of them legitimately had or held responsibilities and jobs where there was real accountability? Do you think that how they view their mission is anything close to what Lincoln's view was of government's mission, being of the people, by the people, for the people, that he mentioned in the Gettysburg Address? Or do you think they have something different in mind? And they, you know, hold frightening sway over many of us across society. So there's a tremendous amount of influence that they hold sway over. Getting that right, getting that mission right is critically important. We need to question that. That's sort of our job as citizens of this country. We're going to talk about academia and campuses of higher education, colleges and universities. You look at those institutions today, are they really genuinely interested in what we think of as parents or as students or as employers of the educational mission? I think they've got a mission in mind, but it is nothing like, and it's in stark contrast to what a parent wants for her kid, what a company wants for a new hire, or for what a student is desiring with respect to their four-year investment. Maybe instead, the mission that you see when you look at higher education in colleges and universities is generally to politicize science and to indoctrinate students with a closed-minded rhetoric, maybe to persecute views or research that's counter to that rhetoric. It's those types of things that are really troubling when they become meshed within and embedded within our educational processes and journeys that basically young adults with impressionable minds are going to be going through. That's a long-term problem facing our society and our country. But we'll talk a lot more about that in subsequent podcasts. We'll talk about media and we'll talk about journalism. Journalism, to me, was one of the most crucial professions that we had in this country not long ago. And I think it showed by attracting some of the most talented people from every generation. I mean, Winston Churchill, outside of the United States, he started his career as a journalist. There's certainly numerous examples within our American experience where the same thing happened. A healthy functioning society, it just relied on journalism to protect personal rights by creating transparency. And it helped, I think, to really spur advancement, whether it was the economy or science or civil rights or whatever the case might be. And that dialogue and that debate was just vital to who we are and how we went about evolving. Today, a very different situation. Instead of objective journalism, I think you find widespread bias. And this idea or concept of fake news, it's not something that was hatched out of nowhere. That was a work in progress, unfortunately, for some period of time. And I think people are waking up to that, that truth and logic may not be the assumed attributes that you see when you're reading the news or viewing the news today. So, you know, those are areas that we're going to look at, to question, to delve into. Why are we doing that? We're doing that for our region. We're doing that for the middle class. We're doing that for the kids and our grandkids whose futures need to be brightened. And when you look at what's at stake, to not speak up is almost in many ways an ethical failure, especially if you're sitting in the seat of a business person with a position of influence and leadership. You've got an ethical duty to speak up and to at least rebut or debate or push back on these relentless attacks of, again, what I'd reference as elites on our corners of the world and our ways of life. Now I'm going to wrap up this podcast with a note of caution. I am aware of the consequences of speaking up, and I've got a little bit of angst with respect to that because two reasons. One, there's always risk involved with that type of an endeavor. But again, as I said, there's almost an ethical, moral duty to do so. To not do so would be a moral failure. But I've also, there's a second reason. I've also, for many years and decades, really embraced the philosophy of, I call it political quietism, right? When attacks would come down the pike or unfair vilification would occur of an industry that I cared about or a region of Western Pennsylvania or the natural gas industry or the company, you would take the approach of keep your head down, stick to execution, focus on what you can control, keep the noise out of the room, right? Sticks and stones may break your bones, but names will never hurt you. And for years, I think that's not just something that I subscribe to, but I think something that worked quite well. But when you think about what John Ruskin once said, he said, quote, "You may either win your peace or buy it. Win it by resistance to evil, buy it by compromise with evil," end quote. I think that is really emblematic of what we're facing today. The approach of political quietism, it's no longer something that's palatable, at least to me personally. And I think business people across the spectrum, unfortunately, are not running toward the ethical and moral duty to speak up. So I'm hoping that maybe one of the motivations of putting out these podcasts and writing The Leech, the book, and posting content on the website is to not just create a discussion and a debate about these issues that are very important to all of us, but also to try to motivate and incentivize other business people to speak up in defense of their self-interests, in defense of their companies, in defense of their industries, their teams, and their regions. Really, when you think about it, all we're talking about here is standing up and defending what you hold near and dear to your heart. But again, today the culture is very much one of doing the opposite. Today, probably the braver business person is ascribing to political quietism and just keeping quiet, whereas the weaker-minded ones are actually voicing support for the very things, ideas, philosophies, and institutions that are looking to draw ruin down upon those businesses and those employees and those customers in those regions and quality of life that they've been tasked with increasing, growing, and optimizing. So that's some of the thoughts and motivations on who I am and how we got here and why we're embarking upon this journey. And again, potential constant listener and constant reader, I hope that you will join us each week to tune in to another podcast of The Far Middle, and also to give a read to the next chapter installment of The Leech. I look forward to speaking to you in the coming weeks, and I will speak to you again here in 1 week from today. Thank you.